Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. I'm delighted today to welcome back not only a regular contributor, but a man who is in his own right a fintech legend and has been working with us for many, many years now, Jim Marus. And Jim, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Happy New Year.
How is things going over at the Banking Transformed podcast?
Well, we're starting off our, it'll be the third calendar year we start off, but it's only our second year of podcasting. We have a lot of great guests coming up, and I'm really looking forward to, with so much change going on in the marketplace, it's, as you know, very exciting to not only engage with brand new guests, but even revisit some of the guests we've had in the past, because there's so many things that are different in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I think we don't do that often enough as well. For Breaking Banks as well, you know, like there's guys that I just was in touch with Ben Milne the other day. He was one of my first guests, actually. You know, remember Ben from Dwala? Same like you know, the guys from various startups in the UK and stuff that we haven't had on for a while.
Josh Reich would not be a bad person to reconnect with as well.
Well, yeah, I spoke to Josh the other day, of course, because of the simple stuff, and we had a good connection. But you know, he's moving to Australia to do farming, I think, you know, I don't like, so
the beauty of retirement.
Yeah. Anyway. But he you know, I spoke to both, Josh and Shamir, for those of you that aren't familiar, as part of the PNC acquisition of BBVA's assets in the US, they also acquired Simple, and, it's been, they're winding down Simple. So that's sort of the end of an era. We won't get into this that on this show, but we've also got Irenia Contolato. Is that how I pronounce it, Irenia?
Yeah, it's well, it's Contolato, but it's Greek, so it's very hard to pronounce. Yes,
Tikanis Kala.
I'm very good. Ευχαριστώ πολύ.
Πολύ καλά. Ευχαριστώ. Okay. Irenia holds the position of VP of Business Development at Scientia, and she's in charge of partnerships and international expansion. Also joining us is Pavel Altschik. How do I pronounce that, Pavel?
Altschik, but don't worry
Altschik,
about it.
Altschik. He's the co-founder and CEO of Frost. Now, for differentiation purposes, this is Frost of the UK, not Frost of Texas, if you're listening from the US. Frost is a smart digital bank account, lives on your smartphone. And today, what we're going to get into is we're going to talk a little bit about Frost. We're going to talk a bit about benchmarking and look at insights that we get from that, and including looking at as sort of the process of how benchmarking can prime your differentiation at a business plan level if you're a startup. So like Frost, and how Frost is engaged with Scientia throughout this process. So that's sort of the plan today. Scientia is not just in the fintech space. Irenia, could you tell us a little bit more about the scope of Scientia's activities and businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. So Scientia has been a consulting firm for almost a decade now. We do a lot when it comes to fintech. One of our business lines is building the business requirements when it comes to digital banking. We've worked with almost 40 banks worldwide, but one of our favorite business lines is Fintech Insights, which is a platform, a digital banking research platform. Very nice tool. Pavel will absolutely testify to that. So what we do in Fintech Insights is that we have an amazing team of analysts, and we have acquired banking accounts from worldwide. So we have bank accounts from USA, Australia, Europe, any part of the world. And then our team of analysts takes over. They log in these banks, the digital banking applications, web, iOS, Android, whatever they have. And they go in and document everything. Now, you've probably heard this before, but when we say we document, we literally mean everything. So we document everything that is offered in digital banking. We have videos about everything. But we also go a step further and we actually evaluate the UX. We have a very concrete and objective methodology all about UX. And then we're able through this platform to compare banks, which might seem odd because one might be, oh, so you can't compare banks. You can't compare apples to oranges. Like you can compare Barclays with Revolut. They're two completely different entities. But we made it possible. Yes, you can compare Barclays and any other bank, any other challenger. And this is what I think will be worthy talking about today. We have compared some banks to each other and we come up with five fun facts about it.
Great. Jim, when you look at all the challenger bank activity around the globe, we've got I think last count, there's over 250 challenger banks globally now. In fact, I could be well out of date with that number, but we just had the Banker magazine launch their ranking of challenger banks. A bunch of others of those have come out. It doesn't seem to be, despite everything, it doesn't seem to be slowing down. What's your view of sort of the challenger bank market on a global basis in terms of the activity there?
But, you know, it's interesting, not just the challenger bank market, but even the digital component of legacy banks. I think what's interesting is they are continually jockeying for position. I think as we're analyzing organizations globally, we're seeing that many of the legacy banks are bringing on board a lot of the functionality and capabilities that digital banks have really been privy to for years. And I think COVID really instigated that when everybody's forced to do digital banking, and if somebody's going to upgrade their digital banking capabilities, they can't do it in a bubble and in a vacuum. So they really have to look beyond their four walls to see how to do it. Now, the difference between challenger bank and many legacy banks is that challenger banks, a lot of the digital capabilities are built in. So you really don't have to look at what you've had and convert it to something that feels digital. And for legacy banks, I think the biggest challenge that we see is that when you analyze the functionality and capabilities of legacy banks, even in the digital banking capabilities, you sometimes lose speed, you sometimes lose simplicity, you sometimes have the back office that doesn't functionally work with the front application the way it does in a digital bank. Now, that being said, and because of COVID, this is transforming very quickly, which is why it's so important to have organizations really monitoring what's happening, because we're seeing changes happening every single day. While at legacy banks, many times upgrades would happen, as you well know, Brett, maybe once a year. So these upgrades and this capability, I mean, some of the bigger banks, and it's a lot of it's defined by size right now, either the very big or the very small, are bringing on capabilities that are replicating and are duplicating or have been bought by or bought from fintech providers. Right. Because I think exactly. Some of the capabilities of some of the fintech firms, they're not getting scale. And so they're looking to sell some of their innovations, some of their functionality to legacy banks.
Yeah. So Pavel, in the light of this highly competitive market where you've got some now highly visible, challenger brands that are doing quite well around the world. How do you go about launching? How do you differentiate in this space? Frost is launching this new smart bank account, smart digital bank account. That as a moniker is not new. Monzo used that in their advertising when they launched into the UK. So how do you differentiate in this space?
Yeah, sure. That's a very good question. First of all, thanks for having me, Brett and Jim. Pleasure to join your podcast. A few words about Frost and the difference in the crowded UK market. The first players such as Monzo, Revolut, Starling, they kind of show the customers that there is a need of digitization and customers expect more from their usual banks such as Barclays, Lloyds, etc. And we also noticed that this is just the beginning. Customers want more and more. And we decided to launch Frost because we are on a mission to save both time and money of our customers. Due to the high expectations of busy individuals, which are our target customer group, and these are people who juggle their career with their life and they don't have time to download 10 different apps, want to look after their savings, want to look after their investment, another one to find their better deals for utility. We believe that being positioned as a current account provider, we can create the smart save assist functionality, which does various things for you. One of the things which we are currently tackling is a big thing in the UK, energy comparison and switching. Just by being Frost a customer, we can pull your data about your usage from various sources and create your profile and notify you when you're eligible that there is a better deal. And you can switch within app with a few clicks to a new provider. And that's something which we are deploying to all the other areas such as insurance, mortgages, remortgage in the UK is, again, even bigger thing. People don't have time to gather all their data, do the market research, speak to the brokers, and find better mortgage deal. And they just stay on the variable rate and overpay. And that applies to insurance and utilities as well. And we knew that this is going to be big, and there is huge demand for that because people don't have time or willpower to do those tasks. But we didn't want to create just another add-on app which sits on your account, because we believe these add-on apps, which, for example, feed on your on open banking data, are geared towards savvy people who have time to go and find them and work with them. We want to have everything in one central place and be account of the choice for our customers by providing them this additional automated functionality where you don't have to type in much, if at all. For example, with our utility, for 90% of our customers in UK, they don't have to type even a single thing. Everything is fully automated. With the other products, they might have to type some data, but it's still far from what would they have to do on an insurance comparison website or when they were looking for a better mortgage deal. And we actually leveraged fintech insights in our build of Frost because we also knew...
You're anticipating my next question, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Go on. And Jim's next question. So, Jim, you were going to ask about
this. Yeah, I just, you know, it's interesting because obviously in your innovation and your development of what you have, you need to look at what the competitors are offering and how they continue to jockey for position and being able to provide the capability. So how do you use the benchmarking currently with your organization in your innovation and development process?
Yeah, so luckily for us, we've got quite a good, strong team, although it's not a big team. We're quite small comparing to all the big players like Revolut, Chime in the US, or all the other well-known names. And we need to find an edge. And we believe we found that edge in terms of benchmarking and testing who's having what with FinTech Insights. It gives us loads of data and comparisons to all the existing players in the neobanking sphere as well as non-neobanking sphere. So with just a few clicks, our team of UX and UI developers can quickly find who's doing what and in what capacity. And we leverage that to cover the basics first because we knew we also have to have a strong UX and UI. The app itself needs to be seamless in usage. You need to know how to use it day one. So with FinTech Insights, we use that to make sure our basics are covered, but also we leverage that to look into a bit more advanced things. So a few months ago, Revolut in the UK announced that they launched the utility switch functionality. So we were thinking, okay, not good because we haven't launched yet. But we quickly discovered that what they've done is far from what we've built. It's behind what we actually built because they do nothing else than just take you to a comparison website and you have to start typing all your data anyway. So we built significantly better product. And we could validate that very quickly with FinTech Insights.
When you're looking at doing your comparisons, can you give us an example of, let's say, one of the, I know you've done a number of different comparisons between organizations. Can you give us an example of one of the comparisons you've done in the banking world?
So the magic, let's say, about fintech insights is not that it runs exclusively on comparisons. Comparisons is one factor that the platform is able to do. What we do is we have the digital banking fully analyzed. So for example, like Paul said, as soon as Revolut came out with that utility bill switch, our team of analysts was on top of it. They logged it in the platform, including the video. They evaluated the UX. So as soon as we had all the data, you can switch to our dashboards and run the comparison between Bank of America versus Revolut, including everything. And it is very important for us, of course, to give all this data up to date, because Power, for example, he's CEO of a challenger bank. He makes decisions on this data. Cannot make decisions when it comes to investments and a bank based on outdated Q1 2020 market report data. You have to know what's currently offered in the market, not just from your competition. You have to know what is currently offered in the market. So to answer your question about comparisons, we run a lot of comparisons when it comes to getting out lots of blogs, articles. It really depends on our mood. It really depends on what's trending. When Starling came out, when Ann Bowden came out with the book, we quickly ran to run comparisons with what Starling offers versus Lloyd's versus Monzo to kind of benchmark it. We have really good findings when it comes to Starling versus Lloyd's. And we also love to benchmark banks in the US because that's a completely different environment, right? Banking in the US is completely different to what is offered in Europe. So we run a lot of comparisons between Ally and PNC. I would be happy to share some fun facts that we found.
Please. Yeah, we'd love that.
Yeah. So when it comes, let's start with some hard numbers, right?
So this is Starling versus Lloyd's, right?
This is Starling versus Lloyd's. I'm going to start with some just rough numbers. So when it comes to Starling, they offer 63% more functionalities in their mobile banking, which I know, obvious, they're a challenger bank. They work from your phone compared to Lloyd's. But when you think about it, Lloyd's has been around for many, many years. Why are they not switching all these functionalities to their mobile banks?
Right. People, in fact, they launched their mobile app well before Starling even existed, right?
Exactly. So you can just see when it comes to high streets in the UK, they're so behind to what is in their digital banking. When it comes to user experience, actually, though, they have about the same user experience for their mobile apps. Only when it comes to web digital banking, Lloyd's has a better user experience. And that is predominantly caused because of the many type of accounts that Lloyd's offers. So they're able to execute more user journeys, is what I mean. So thus, they have a higher user experience when it comes to web. Now, there are a lot of things that are missing from both banks. Obviously, Lloyd's is missing kids' accounts, which is a very big trend when it comes to fintech as of lately. And in my opinion, a very genius way to get customers from a very, very early age, because think about this. Children, you get a junior account for your child. They get accustomed to that UI. They get accustomed to earning money, finding the value behind getting money, they become financial literate. But when they get to 18, 19, they will most likely continue with Revolut because it is similar to what they're used to. It is easy for them to switch. And I wouldn't be taken aback if Revolut made a very nice switch from your junior account to become eligible to your regular Revolut account. So Lloyd's, not a Kite account. Kite accounts actually have very fancy debit cards, which is really nice when you want to drink a child. And also, one thing, they do not have foreign currency accounts. So
who doesn't have foreign currency?
Lloyd's Bank. Oh. So, you know,
not in their mobile app.
Not in their mobile app, but even if you go to their web digital banking, they do have some like application where you can start getting your euro account from your British pound account. But there's so many eligibility criteria that is very hard to meet.
Right.
And the fees, the monthly fees are astonishing. So if you live in the UK, it would be better for you to switch to Starlink since they offer a foreign currency account, yeah, including with your GBP account. Why stay with Lloyds? That's what we're asking.
Okay.
And why is Lloyds just sitting there doing nothing about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Pavel, when did you inject this sort of benchmarking into the design process for Frost?
To be honest, it was quite early. When we first met Erenia and her colleague Alexandros, we already had the basics covered, such as onboarding, peer-to-peer transfers, international transfers, ordering the card, and basic banking functionality. So we already had that in place, and then we met them, we joined the platform, and kind of improved what we already created and what we've designed based on the additional data which we had.
Great. So, Jim, I thought we should also get into sort of this trend we're seeing here. You know, Google Pay has obviously launched a big new wallet update in the US, but likewise, we're seeing, you know, Apple now to start getting in the replacement potentially for your current account or your checking account. But certainly in China, we've seen massive growth of these alternative day-to-day bank accounts. So, Erenia, you know, if you're a bank, you know, do you think, can you get an Apple for Apple's comparison with, say, a Google Wallet versus a debit card from a challenger bank?
I think yes. I mean, it really depends on your strategy, right? It really depends on what you aim to do as a bank. For example, Frost, they aim to do something really specific. Starlink, Anne said it herself, I just want to focus on the current account. I'm going to rely on experts for other products. I don't want to mess with loans. I don't want to mess with investments. That will be taken care of by other providers, which she did in her marketplace, and she did it exceptionally. So it really has to do with your strategy. If you want to be compared to a wallet, is your strategy striving towards becoming the best competitor to a wallet? Are you looking to expand that functionality set? If yes, look at Google Wallet, but also look at the rest of the world, because you will be taken aback. Sometimes we work with banks from all over the world, right? And as of lately, we saw some banks from Latin America, and they have exceptionally good functionalities when it comes to Google Wallet, when it comes to adding your cards in your wallets and just making your life easier. Because I think where we're heading right now with fintech is an all-in-one approach. As Powell said, you do not want to have to download multiple applications in order to manage your finances, which is a recurring thing that we come across when it comes to banking in the USA. For example, for PNC, you have to download, I think, more than 6 applications. One of them is for managing your current account and your checking account. One of them is managing your prepaid debit card. Another one is for investments. Previously, they had another separate application when it comes to PFM and just money management. And now they have integrated that into the main application. But how do we expect people, especially towards younger generations, how do you expect people to just flood their screens with multiple applications to manage their money?
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. They're just not going to do it.
Jim, you've got a personal stake in this, right?
Well, my business account's at PNC, but I'm also very familiar with the organization. But how do you look at, let's say PNC is a great example where they have virtual wallet, which actually combines a checking account with a savings plan with credit availability. How do you benchmark when organizations have different strategies, maybe for different demographic groups or for within different parts of the organization? How do you monitor, let's say, their traditional checking account versus their virtual wallet account?
Well, when it comes to the analysis part, we treat it as one entity. So if somebody logs into FinTech Insights right now, they're going to see the entire functionality that PNC as a financial institution holds. But we also have the information of, look, this is not an all-in-one solution. Because if somebody else, let's say, not even an institution from the US, maybe a bank from London, a bank from Greece, whatever, if they look at PNC and their offering and they will see a huge number of functionalities, let's say 700 functionalities, but this is not true. Yes, they offer all these functionalities, but they offer them separately. So we have this information of, in this specific application, this is the number of functionality and this is the UX that they are providing. This is a specific functionality set for a specific application, and they maybe have a different UX when it comes to that. Because you have to look at it both in a bigger picture way. So is the user experience of PNC good? Well, as of right now, if I have to open hundreds of applications, no. But is the UX of just a specific application good? Because I might be interested in only looking for my checking account. Is the experience I'm getting from that particular application good? In that case, yes, that might be true. You might be getting a wonderful user experience.
So this also speaks to the whole design premise, because you could have functionality spread across different parts of the business, but customers getting access to that becomes problematic. So, Jim, I'd like to talk about your experience with PayPal on a day-to-day basis versus, say, PNC Wallet. You're using that a lot more in your own business these days, right?
Yeah, I think just one of these interesting dynamics that, Rini, I'm sure you're up against, is that it's a consumer's impression of what all these are, probably more so than what we may be evaluated. For instance, in my situation, my business account, you know, there's probably many people that are very satisfied with their PNC business account. On the other hand, for me, because of the fact that I receive payments via PayPal and I do disbursements via PayPal, PayPal has been very responsive, taking the data that they get on me and applying it towards other offers. So they offer me a regular ongoing line of credit. They offer me business bridge loans, things of this nature, which PNC doesn't do because they don't use data the same way. So in that context, how do you, or are you looking to in the future, look at consumer perception of organizations and what they do with the accounts? Because sometimes what we see from a knowledge basis of what we see in a marketplace may not be the way the consumer's experience actually is. Are you looking at potentially, or do you currently look at the consumer reaction to these different accounts?
Yes, so it is worth to know here that when we say we evaluate the UX, we actually look at the consumer's point of view. So when we say we evaluate the UX, we attribute scores, right? So every single user journey that we analyze, and we analyze more than like 500 user journeys for each bank and then scale that up to each application that they use. We have scores starting from 1,000 and going all the way down. It can even have like a negative score. And we do that for user journeys, and it can be as simple or as complex. So it can be as simple as digital onboarding, very buzzworthy word there, but it can be as complex as, well, I want to start a goal and I want to set a recurring transfer to reach that goal, but I also want to get notified every time I reach a specific milestone. This is a very complex user journey. It's a user need. Somebody actually asked for us to run this UX. So what we do is we actually calculate and evaluate the effort that the user needs to make and invest in order to successfully complete that user journey. Mm. And the effort is measured in different ways. So it doesn't have to do with just clicks, because I know there's a lot of trending talks out there like, oh, who has the best
32 versus 6 clicks. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not about clicks. It's not about just typing. It's not about just looking at screens for a couple of seconds. No, it has to do with, do I have to only click? Do I have to manually type all my personal information, or are you just going to make it easier for me and I'm going to have to just tap my passport and there you go, here's all my data? Do I have to go through the whole KYC process as soon as I want to become a customer, or Am I going for a different solution?
Is it a progressive KYC? Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So, all right, Irene, because we're running out of time, so I don't want to miss the opportunity to sort of here do a couple of things, you know, give some visibility to you guys and Frost. Pavel, when is Frost scheduled to launch in beta?
In terms of actual beta, we have launched already last month. We've got some beta testers using the app, although the beta testers don't have access to actual money. We only loaded their accounts with.
So the full launch is dependent on the regulator at the moment.
That's right. Yeah, okay. And I can't give you the exact date. But
no, I understand that. Well, keep us informed. Let us know. How do people go and sign up for the beta program?
Basically, they can go to frost.app and join the waitlist, and we handpick people from the waitlist so they can join the beta testing phase before we launch live.
Fantastic. And Irenia, how do we find out more information about FinTech Insights and Scientia in general?
Well, the first step would be to go in our website. So that's scientiaconsulting.com/fintechinsights. There you can book your demo. We can go through some comparisons together, maybe uncover some secrets that you didn't know, maybe together with your digital banking team, innovation team, UX team as well. They can also watch out for our blog. We post a lot of comparisons there as well, a lot of insights.
Fantastic. Well, Irenia, thank you for joining us. Pavel and Jim, thanks for being with us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yasu, Irenia.
Yasu, Brad.
Okay. All right, we'll go to break, guys. We'll be back with more Breaking Banks after a few words from our sponsors.
Today's podcaast is brought to you by Plaid. If you're building a fintech app or service, Plaid is the easiest way to get started. With Plaid's API, your users can securely connect their bank accounts to your app in seconds. Over 3,000 of some of the most popular fintech apps and services are already powered by Plaid. In fact, 1 in 4 U.S. adults have used Plaid to connect their account to an app that can help them pay back their roommate for last night's pizza, save money on holiday shopping, or take control of their financial future. With just a few lines of code, you can start building with Plaid today. Visit plaid.com/breakingbanks to learn more.
Why not become the bank your customers crave? With FinTech Insights, you can now go behind your competitors' login screens and experience them as a customer would, so you can understand where they excel and how they learn from their mistakes. Find out exactly how your competitors tackle the same challenges. Benchmark each bank against the market, compare banks to each other, and build digital banking experiences that delight at every login. Book your demo now at scientiaconsulting.eu/fi. scientiaconsulting.eu/fi.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
All right. Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is JP Nichols, and I'm excited to have back on the show Dr. Lita Gliptis. Lita is the Chief Client Officer at 10X Future Technologies. Lita, always a pleasure to have you on the show. So thanks for joining us.
Be here.
And also joining us is Alex Barkley. Alex currently manages the HSBC Venture Capital FinTech Investment Portfolio. He specializes in strategy and commercial operations. And prior to that, he was the global head of FinTech procurement at HSBC, responsible for bridging the gap between small, agile fintechs and the wider bank. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today. And we've talked about this on the show before, and we always use the air quotes of this idea about bank
/fintech partnerships. And as Ron Shevlin loves to point out, they're rarely really partnerships. They're vendor agreements. And yet, if we reduce them to merely vendor agreements and we go through the usual hoops around procurement, we often don't end up with the outcomes that we want either. So, Alex, first of all, welcome to the show. And I'd just love to hear your opening thoughts on that big topic. And we'll get into it as we go on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been a big fan of the show, so it's great to get on. I think it's a pretty punchy statement that Brett makes there. And I think unless you've been living under a rock for the last 5 years, I think, you know, banks recognize that the way that we worked in the past isn't going to work in the future, especially with the kind of shifting landscape around digital. And I think we as a group are recognizing that the way that we've contracted and the way we've partnered with people in the past hasn't worked. So I think you can pull tons of examples of where it hasn't. And I think that's starting to change. So, you know, there are green shoots out there. I think, you know, the challenges that we've seen historically are still there. Things are tough, but it is getting better. You know, and I think we recognize that if banks are going to be competitive into the future, if we're going to compete with, you know, the likes of the challenger banks that are starting up, you know, the tech companies, the Amazons, the Googles, the Baidus, the Tencents, we need to work with people, you know, in this kind of ways. So for me, you know, one of the reasons I was so keen to do this is procurement has become a differentiating factor. You know, if we don't get this right, people don't want to come and work with us. You know, they don't want to partner with us. We know we can't do it ourselves. And obviously, that's going to become a problem for us in the future.
Right. As Brett likes to say, if you, you know, you're asking my three-person startup to sign this, you know, 50-page document and indemnity agreement for your multi-billion dollar bank, it's really not a kind of level playing field. And nor will it ever be a level playing field, but we have to adjust it if we're going to go forward. So what are some of the specifics? I mean, what have you seen in terms of worst practices and best practices on the way to do this right and not fall down the typical procurement hole?
I mean, the contract is a great place to start. You know, like when I first started in banking, we were doing exactly that. You know, we were sending out enterprise agreements that were like phone books to startups that were three guys and a dog in an office in Silicon Valley. And you know, it was just turning people off. You know, it was taking too long. And you know, I think one of the big things that we did at HSBC was move away from that style of contracting. We built a series of documents that, okay, look, they weren't, you know, one sheet of paper, but they were, you know, easy for people to use. They were accessible. And we tried to be as pragmatic as we could, you know, that I think there are things that we recognize, you know, and I won't get into specifics, but, you know, asking people to sign unlimited liabilities when it's three guys and a dog in an office, there's not a lot of point to that. And actually being sensible about how, you know, if that company ever went into, you know, anything ever went wrong, what are you going to go and get from the guys, you know, the fluff in their pockets and the copper wiring in the walls? That's not going to cover anywhere near the kind of the damages that we would need. So being, you know, working with startups to develop more mature positions, you know, things that are a little bit more, you know, a little bit more pragmatic. I think there's still definitely a fear. And I, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this was to potentially address some of that around contracting with banks, you know, and I think the, you know, Twitter is full of examples of where, you know, banks perhaps haven't behaved as well as they should have done. I don't really think that's necessarily the case. As I said, I think we recognize that we need to partner with people. And if we annoy everyone and we're shown to be, you know, we misbehave, we're not going to get that. We're not going to get those people wanting to work with us with those great ideas. And I think that fear has stopped a lot of collaboration. You know, people will come into it with doors raised. They'll be very protective about their IP. They'll be quite rightly so, but they'll be protective about all kinds of things. And for us, I think being as transparent as we can, I mean, that's the big thing for me in all of this, is both sides of the equation need to be more transparent. You know, us as banks, we need to be more open about what we're looking for from people and what our expectations are. And vice versa, on the startup side, I think we need to, you know, there's a little bit more transparency needed about where they need help. You know, if it's a thing around things like payment terms, you know, whatever it is. And we're talking, you know, we're getting into talking about very specific vendor contracts again, but just some of those things, I think, you know, really have stopped us in the past.
Well, Lita, you have been on really all sides of this issue throughout your career. I mean, what would you add to what Alex has said so far?
So it's funny because I was both frantically nodding and jotting things down. I don't disagree with the word Alex said. He's brought it to life in a way that brings some very painful memories. And I think the worst of banking procurement is changing, right? But the reality is that those indemnification clauses and 19 pages of requirements for bank accounts and documentation going back 10 years for a startup that is 6 months old is increasingly a thing of the past. But what is not a thing of the past is the learned behaviors. And what we're seeing a lot in banks, particularly the ones that don't have a function like the one Alex used to be in of fintech procurement, is that once you pass the chief procurement officer and you're talking to anyone below them, they have a playbook, they have tools, and they have absolutely no incentive to help you, because helping you is violating their own terms of service. And it's a massive shift. And in my career, I'd say that I've never found a chief procurement officer who wasn't willing and able to help me. But the minute he left the room, the problem started. So rethinking the tools that people need to have in order to do the job without them needing to stop and think about risk calibration is a massive piece from a banking perspective. One of the things we're definitely seeing is that banks are getting very good at this exercise when they're investing. So when you're both an investor and a user, the banks have gotten actually pretty good at it, at managing to take you through the process and doing so with enough separation and enough understanding. I see that in my current role with our investor partners. I saw that in my previous role. Where it gets very hard is when the bank is just a client, because not every bank is going to be an investor. And having that that risk mindset that allows the bank to get what they need in terms of assurances in a way that isn't locked into the traditional indemnification approach, because as Alex says, what are you going to do? Get the fluff in people's pockets or the dog that was sitting there with the three guys in the beginning. Now, the default position there is putting the code in escrow. And we were very, very used to banks going, well, you're going to put your code in escrow. And these are the ever-increasing situations in which I might get my paws all over that that code. And that's increasingly becoming redundant, because the banks, 9 times out of 10, wouldn't know what to do with that escrow. So the very interesting conversations I found myself in over the last few years on both sides of the table, as you say, JP, is the assurances that the banks are beginning to ask as part of the procurement process around talent. It's like, what are you going to do to make sure that your best engineers don't leave? And the answer is, there's nothing I can do. Make the job interesting. We'll continue to pay them well. We'll hope for the best. But it's an interesting exercise, because essentially what we're talking about here is comfort, risk. And I don't mean risk appetite. I mean risk calibration and tooling.
So there's a lot to unpack what you said there. But let's start with risk calibration. What does that mean to you? Because I want to talk about that. Because I think that for many organizations, and particularly banks and particularly bankers, they tend to view risk as pretty binary. Things are either risky or not risky. And so what does risk calibration mean to you?
So that, I love you for asking that question, and everyone can go home now, because I'm going to talk for the rest of our segment, because I feel very strongly about this.
Thanks,
and
you Alex. Know that.
I, you're absolutely right. The way banks traditionally look at risk is extremely binary. And even when it's not binary, it's actually mathematical. It's, you know, if this is our assumed risk and this is the remedial action, this is the residual risk, and we have a formula for calculating it, and we're all happy with that. And there's always a set of choreographed moves you have to make, documents, checklists, to protect yourself and be able to show that you did the right thing. So even if you end up suffering a loss, reputational or material, if you show that you have actually gone through the dance of risk, capital R, then you're mostly fine. And I think the reason we behave like that in banking is because historically the regulators assessed us in that way. So you needed your checklists and your matrices. And even if things went terribly wrong, if you showed that you had done the right things, you were actually largely in the clear, and people developed behaviors and tools around that. Three things have changed between then and now. One is the regulator. The regulator does not do that anymore. The regulator is actually extremely dynamic in terms of looking at what ought to happen and how, but risk departments haven't quite caught up with that. The second is that the world has changed so much that the things that were deemed risky have changed 10 times. And quite a lot of our risk calibrations are so relevant. I remember I was still at BNY Mellon, so we're talking almost 10 years ago, and senior risk committee had Twitter listed as an emergent risk. Would have been 10, would have been 8 years ago. And you're like, what emergent risk? It's emerged. It's here. What's emergent about that? So the timings with which things are updated are slow. But to get to the point of what you're asking, our definition of risk is not about what am I trying to achieve and what might stop me. It's what do I need to be seen to be doing so I don't get into trouble? So the exam question is very different. I won't say wrong, because actually you probably need both of those things. But if the exam question is what do I need to be seen to be doing versus what might stop me from success, you end up with all the problems that Alex described at the beginning.
Yeah, well, I want to, well, Alex, first of all, I just love your thoughts on that. And then I want to kind of circle back to the role of, you know, does that get better when they're an investor? Because maybe part of the issue is when you're an employee that's has no upside to success, right? All I can do is protect on the downside. There's this asymmetric risk reward was really non-existent, right? There's only downside for me as a corporate functionary. When I'm investing, there starts to become a little bit more of a relationship of the ups and downs. What do you think of all that?
I mean, first off, with what Lida said, I really couldn't agree more. I remember looking at some processes when I first started in FS that, you know, I looked, I was kind of like, why are we doing this? You know, what's the point of this, you know, information? Like, I get it if it was there to, you know, to enhance the risk. And I think if you look at, or to mitigate the risk, you know, if you look at, you know, you look at some of the things that have been in press recently, you know, like Wirecard, for example, you know, there are risks with this stuff, you know, they're maybe not quite as big as Wirecard, but there are risks in the nature of what we do. You know, financial services does contain risk. But actually, you know, completing a form for the sake of filling a form, which will take you 3 days, and then you've got to go to a committee that aren't going to look at it. And there's no point in doing that. You'd be much better off picking the phone up to somebody and having a conversation about it and getting, you know, the people who understand that risk in the room with somebody, or talking to somebody who is in a position to say yes or no, should we take this risk or should we shouldn't. So I couldn't agree more with Lida. And I think that is changing in FS. I think that those two kind of things are starting to get closer together, you know, the robust need for regulation, as we've already kind of talked about, with a slightly more nuanced way of working. To your second point around ventures, look, I mean, for us, we see it as a differentiating factor as an investor, is that, you know, for us to be able to come into a company and to help them, you know, move around the bank, help them cover off some of the more, you know, when they get stuck, to be somebody at the end of a phone. You know, I've lost count of the amount of times that people rang me up and said, you know, look, I just need to talk to somebody. Like, I don't want to send this into a black box where nobody emails me back, or it's you know, some contact center offshore. You know, I want to talk to a real person who can help me out and who really cares. You know, I feel very passionately that procurement, you know, could save the world. You know, I'm relatively young. I see my career in banking. You know, I'm 35. I think I've probably got another 30 years left if I'm unlucky.
Oh, and the rest.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we don't get this bit right, I believe it's a question of survival for us. And, you know, so I always felt very passionate about that. And I think giving that passion and linking that, you know, that success back to a corporate function, as we talked about them, giving them, you know, empowering them with good work. You know, Lida said it when we were talking earlier, giving somebody good work to do and so they understand where they are in that cog is really critical. So we play that role as an investor. And yeah, look, I never worked harder when I worked and I was in procurement than when somebody rang me up, you know, a C-level exec rang me up and told me to do something, or they rang my boss up and told me to do something. It was usually a case of how high. And as investors, we can do that. You know, we see, and as I said, we see that as a value add as corporate investors. You know, and that's hopefully why people take our money.
Yeah. Again, every thread we pull on, there's a lot behind there of what you said, and I want to come back to the investing thing, because I want to talk about organizations that don't have venture capital arms like you, but increasingly banks are making equity investments, and I think one root of this problem, whether you're investing or partnering, procuring with a fintech company, is the very nature that at the end of the day, the core function of a bank is to gather deposits and make loans. And the balance, the leverage nature of the balance sheet means that we've got to be right 99.something% of the time, or we go out of business. And I know, and you know, venture capital investing doesn't work that way. And neither does really most partnerships with early stage companies. And so it's really, yes, it is risky, but you also have to frame that risk. And it's, you also have to scale that risk. It's interesting you mentioned Wirecard. You know, isn't it funny, of all the due diligence that, how many meetings did organizations have to protect their 100,000 pound investment, but they lost billions in Wirecard, right? How does that sort of thing kind of escape through the radar, do you think, Lita? How do we get surprised by these big things when we're looking so hard at the little ones?
No, you're absolutely right. And it's a very good question. And it points to what we were saying earlier, right? If your risk discipline is around doing the right things, it was almost like a rote learning, then you accept that sometimes things will go wrong. But if you looked at the right places, then it doesn't matter if you didn't find the thing you were looking for, kind of thing. And I'm not trying to be dismissive or cavalier. But for instance, I remember years ago when one of our massive systems providers, the biggest in the market, had an outage over 48 hours, and our teams had to cut NAVs, net asset valuations, by hand, because the system we were using in the fund accounting team had an outage. There were some disaster recovery clauses in the contract. This was a giant, right? They went through procurement because they had 700 people on their side and 700 on our side, and still they had an outage, and still the disaster recovery provisions were not met. And they're still in business. So the reality is that the answer to your question, JP, is exactly what we were talking about earlier, that we have some choreographed motions of how we used to measure risk. And it was about doing the right thing on your side and ticking the boxes and hoping for the best. But things still went wrong. And all it did was protect your organization from either an accusation of sloppiness or an accusation of collusion. But the reality is that the way we did risk mitigation didn't necessarily stop the bad things from happening. It just stopped us from sort of bringing them upon ourselves. So the big things can still go wrong the same way that the little things can go wrong, because the checklist-based risk assessment actually does a fraction of what you need doing. So for me, the question is our procurement broken for fintechs? Yes. Is it good for anything else? I worked for a company, I won't name them, but you'll probably work out very quickly who it was, who failed IBM Europe. The procurement process failed IBM Europe. So we contracted with IBM US, no issues, but IBM Europe failed.
What was the issue?
It was actually an audit issue. Their account, we didn't like them.
Yeah. Well, and there can be inside financial organizations sometimes this perceived reward of, I'm so clever. You know, I'm the one that protected us from IBM Europe.
Yes.
You know, nobody else thought of this, but I did. And that isn't very helpful. I want to go back to the investing thing, though, because I think there's some root causes and commonalities. I also think, as you said, there's some upside because at least now you're measuring risk and reward. But you mentioned that the checklist. Checklists are even less helpful in venture investing. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've been in that they're looking at an early stage company and they want to do a discounted cash flow to figure out the valuation or look at their balance sheet and figure out how much they put in there. That's not what venture valuation looks like. We could do a whole show. Jason will do that show, I'm sure. And Alex, maybe we'll bring you back. But investing still is another level on that. And Alex, this is what I mentioned earlier. You've got a whole arm that you're really a corporate venture capital focused on that. What are you seeing, and maybe with some of the investors that you're making, are you having co-investors who are maybe not so experienced, not so savvy, or maybe just things you're seeing out in the market?
I think, I mean, look, most big banks have got, you know, have got some kind of a VC arm, you know, or are partnering with other funds. So if you, you know, I won't mention any names, but you can, you know, you can see where they don't have in-house venture teams like we do, that they're partnering with existing large funds to help them find those opportunities. I think it's something that's quite difficult just to kind of, you know, you can't just stand up a VC team on its own. You can hire people in, but you know, the kind of experience, the network, the deal flow isn't, or you know, you need to develop that organically, and partnering with a fund kind of makes sense. I would also say, I think that, and I mean, you touched on it as well, that culturally still within banks, you know, is that we can't lose any money, we can't fail. And I don't think, you know, when you compare that mindset with a technology company, for example, you compare that with the way something like Google works, or, you know, the way that they're willing to, you know, to fail quickly with something, to try something that doesn't work and walk away. You know, I think that permeates banking's venture teams as well. You know, we will want to do, you don't see a lot of banks doing super early stuff, you know, like pre-seed, seed kind of investing. It tends to be later stage, tends to be where they have established track records. You know, they tend to work in more corporate ventures style rather than as a traditional VC, you know, so you tend to look at later stage stuff, you know, D's, Series D onwards. I haven't seen anybody doing anything actually in early stage. So I guess we tend to play where our experience is. So for us as enterprise, you know, we consume a lot of enterprise services. It's super easy for us to be able to see where those really interesting companies are. What we aren't great at is that early stuff. And there's probably a really interesting niche there as well that maybe somebody's going to explore in the future.
Well, and I know, Jason, we'll be talking about these things on a future show. And we've talked a little, he's talked a little bit already about some of the investments that we've made, because we're seeing that even the regional and mid-sized banks in the U.S. are starting to become more open to that. But you're right, they don't have the technical expertise always. They don't have the deal flow and all of that. And so being able to do that as a consortium has been super helpful for them. You know, Alex, one of the other things that you've talked about too is just the RFP approach. And there was a bank we worked with recently that told us, hey, we really want to go with a digital banking partner, but we haven't been able to find one. So what do you mean? There's all kinds of digital banking partners. You know, we've talked to X, Y, and Z, and we said, okay, great. What are you trying to accomplish? I said, well, what do you mean? We're trying to do digital lending. Well, right. But, you know, are you trying to solve the back office efficiency? Are you trying to improve the customer experience? Are you trying to improve customer acquisition? And their answer was basically yes. And so we said, well, talk to us about your RFP. It was a 200 and some page RFP. And the way they had thought about it was, unless everybody checked every box, they weren't be able to move forward. So what are your thoughts and experience around that?
I mean, look, we could do a whole separate show about RFPs. Yes. And yes. Look, I worked in for procurement for a long time, right? And I'm not convinced it is the best way to select vendors. Yes, it has its places. And if you're buying, you know, that viewing stuff as a commodity, you know, if I'm buying pens and pencils or ball bearings, absolutely that's the best way to do it. But if I'm buying something nuanced or something new, it just doesn't really get to the heart of what you want. And actually the time it takes, you know, you can't really run an RFI, RFP process in less than a month, really. I've never seen it done properly, probably longer if you're going to do it properly. And I think procurement needs to embrace new ways of doing this. So you know, because really when it boils down to it, if you've managed to get to an RFP, you can probably do the work. And actually, you know, running something like a hackathon, like getting to know somebody and how they're going to work with your team, being able to see the products, you know, those are the things that really matters, not how good they are at filling out an RFP, because those are the people who win RFPs.
Yeah, it's those RFPs. It's those experiential learnings that you have that are never going to be a field on a form.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for me, as I was kind of saying, that the people who win those tend to be the same sorts of people, right? You know, they look like big four consultancies. And I'm not sure they're the right people to be doing a lot of this work, you know, like, but you don't get that because the process is built to favor them. So I think, you know, people are starting to do this in different ways as well. And we talked about, you know, different forms of partnership. You know, I was a big proponent of doing hackathons, right? Just getting stuff people in, saying, look, we've got a problem, help us solve it, help us build something, you know, and you have to think differently in order to do that. But I think the day of the RFP hopefully is gone for these kind of services.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I wish that was the case, but you know, we both know it's not. And I do remember sitting on the inside of a bank, and I was on two committees, because banks like committees, and we were running two very different RFPs. One was for a payments gateway and one was for a digital identity management tool. They would meet somewhere, but they're pretty different things. And the RFP was about 80% the same, because it ran in the hundreds of pages, and the RFP was largely the same because the procurement team was recycling a lot of the stuff. And I remember being at the receiving end of that not so long ago, where my team and I received a spreadsheet that was part of an RFI process that had in excess of 1,200 questions. And when we called the client, it was like, you know that we don't have answers for most of those things. And like, how do you want us to play this? They said, I will never forget this. Not all of the questions matter equally. Don't worry about it. And it's like, well,
guess which ones matter?
And why didn't you just send me those? And of course, the Frankenstein approach meant that there were 20 teams involved. And for some of them, some questions mattered more than others. But the reality is, all questions matter, just not to the same people in the same way. But because you're not in the room for the horse trading, it doesn't play well to the point Alex is making, to anyone who doesn't have a team that can field an acceptable answer to every question. But again, I think it goes full circle back to the question we had earlier about risk. And it's very interesting for me to look at banks who do very risky things, because if you leave your retail banking aside, your institutional banking is actually very risky business. You play with FX volatility, you play with investments that very regularly lose money. You understand the concept of risk hedging. We as an industry have done some pretty unexpected things with like calls, puts and futures. Like, all of that is really risky stuff. And therefore we get risk when it comes to money. We just don't get risk when it comes to process. And one of the things I find interesting is that when the procurement people are not in the room, because Alex, you're not a typical procurement person in any way, right? And the money people are in the room, they're much more comfortable with risk. And therefore, when you have the investment hat on, even though institutional VCs tend to try to bring some of their learned behaviors of how they calibrate a risk hedged portfolio to fintech investment, and then there's a learning curve for them, they're much more comfortable with taking risk than someone who's in a support function, and they would lose their job if they would take a risk. So I think it's about getting the right people in the right job with the right tools, and having people like Alex in a decision-making role to say, you know what, we're going to stop that nonsense. We're not going to do it anymore because it's not helping anybody.
Well, we have a lot of things teed up for future episodes. And you just added another one, which is we're also not good at the risk of not taking risk, right? What's the existential risk if we just keep doing, you know, what we're doing? So we're going to need to wrap here, but I'm going to ask each of you for maybe one piece of advice, Lita, for if you're a bank, and particularly if you're, you know, maybe not a giant bank with, you know, teams of people doing this, what's the one thing you could start doing differently tomorrow? And then Alex, I'll ask you the same thing. If you're selling to the banks, you know, what can you do on your side to help make it easier?
So if you are a bank and you don't have the money to invest, the one thing you can do differently is start respecting the startup's time differently. Because the reality is that the startup founder versus the big bank CEO are worth much less in terms of their per hour remuneration. But time is a much scarcer resource for a startup that has three people and a dog and runway for the next 3 months. So if you want to be the bank that does things differently, accelerating processes in a way that is respectful to a startup's time. I mean, sales cycles go into years sometimes. I know a startup that sold to a big global bank after 6 years of conversations. So if you want to be differentiated, respect their time. Get to yes quickly, get to know quickly. And well, I know, I mean, NO, not get to understand, but get to an answer in a way that is has pace and doesn't use too much of their time, and advertise the fact that you have that level of respect. It will help you stand out from the crowd.
That's a great one. A quick no is the second best answer you can give.
That's right. Absolutely. Right.
Alec, what's your advice for the flip side of the coin?
I think find the right person in the bank. It needs to be the person who has that problem that you're solving, and be a painkiller, not a vitamin to them. Show them the value that you're going to bring. Banks have hundreds of $10 million problems. If you show us how you're going to solve it, we'll bite your hand off to get you in the front door. Like I said, I never worked harder than when the CEO rang me up and told me to do something. So have that person demonstrate the value that it brings, and we'll get you in.
Those are two great pieces of advice. Alex and Lita, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.